morning and welcome to Wanda's Picks, a black and arts and culture program of the African Sisters Media Network. We're listening to Nebulae, Abraham Burton's Nebulae from his album Amina. And we're going to continue that before we play a rebroadcast of an interview with Ramona Africa about the events of Mother's Day weekend and in Philadelphia. And they were just in town, Ramona Africa and Pam Africa, with Lynn Stewart, a Welcome Home Lynn Stewart event this past weekend. Thank you. So that is Abraham Burton's Nebulae on his album Amina. And we were speaking about Lynn Stewart, the people's attorney, her visit to the San Francisco Bay Area Friday, May 2nd through Sunday, May 4th. Hope you were able to catch her, along with Ramona Africa and Pam Africa, Lynn's husband of many years. It was just really, really wonderful seeing her out of prison and looking so well and strong, which was really excellent. So, yeah, it was just really, really wonderful. So I want to tell you a little bit about Ramona Africa. We had an interview with her before she and Pam got on the airplane to Philadelphia to come out here for the Welcome Home Lynn tour and also celebration of Mumia Abu-Jamal's 60th birthday. But we weren't able to play the entire interview. And since this weekend coming is really, it's a sad anniversary. It's the anniversary of Ramona's family and herself being bombed by the city of Philadelphia on May 13th, which was Mother's Day weekend, 1985. And Ramona was the only adult survivor of that bombing of the Move House at 6221 Osage Avenue. Ramona says in an interview that I found online at philly.com that despite the grief and shock, what got her through being burned on 13% of her body and all of her family being killed, she said what got her through was her bitterness. And she actually had to serve 7 years in prison on riot charges stemming from the 1985 confrontation. And she later sued the city and won a settlement on a civil rights judgment of $1.5 million. She was then and is still the group's spokeswoman, and she's often seen in front of the Osage home yelling into a bullhorn calling for the release of the Move followers who were convicted of killing a police officer during a shootout between police and members in 1978. And her family, those of them who are still alive, because I know at least one person has died, Merle Africa, they are still incarcerated and should be released since they have been found suitable. And she talks about that in that conversation. Ramona says in this interview that she continues to uphold Move's causes and beliefs just as she had when she joined in the early 80s. And she said the group's priority is still the unrelenting fight for her brothers and sisters who have been in prison since 1978. And they, like as I mentioned, they've been up for parole more than once and been found suitable, but the prison will not release them. Ramona's traveled to Cuba, South Africa, and several European countries, spreading the message of John Africa. And she says that the police bombing made her very serious about the revolution. And the second degree burns that cover more than 15% of her body remain unrepaired as a reminder about what happened. She says she's not trying to cover it up because of the strength of her beliefs. This doesn't bother her that much. She used the burns as a teaching tool. And this was written by Daphne Tales a while back. And so I'm going to play this interview with Ramona, and I might play something else after that from the archives. And as you listen to the interview, as I mentioned, Ramona's packing for her trip here to the San Francisco Bay Area last weekend. So you'll hear her packing her things. And then when I saw her, she told me that she hadn't been to bed that night. She had been up all night. So she was kind of tired, but she didn't look it. Sister has a lot of fire. So they are preparing for for activities this weekend to commemorate the bombing of the MOVE residents and the death of the MOVE members, all of them except one adult and one child. And now Birdie has also died. So now Ramona is the only survivor of the 1985 bombing. Yeah, I when I saw your email in April, I thought you were coming in April, but then my friend told me that I had misread it, and then I looked at it again. It's like, oh man, I missed the.
We were out there a couple weeks ago.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but, yes, exactly.
We planned on coming back. Jeff Mackler is bringing us out.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for. The Lynn Stewart Momia activities.
Right, yeah, you have a whole lot of great things, you know, planned. Like, as soon as you touch down, you know, first day, you know, you're in the air and then on the ground. All the way through Monday, I believe, right?
Yeah, it's been that way since we came out there, because last time we came out there a couple weeks ago, we got off the plane and went right to UC Berkeley.
Oh, wow. Okay.
You know. Yeah. When we say on the move, that's what we mean.
You know, that is so true. That is so true. It's not just a euphemism. You really are on the move.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah, so bring us up to speed on what's been going on, you know. I mean, I saw Lynn Stewart in February when I was in New Jersey for Imamu Amiri Baraka's homecoming.
Oh, yeah.
And they had that, you know, the great dinner for the political prisoners and prisoners of war,
right.
You know, that that same day. So we went over there, Robert King and I, and that was really wonderful.
Well, there's been a lot going on. You know, we've had a 3-day celebration of life program for Mumia.
Mm-hmm.
And that went great. We had a wonderful dinner on Thursday, April 24th, which is Mumia's birthday.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a message, videotape message from Ross Baraka, Amiri and Amina Baraka's son.
Yes.
And we also had a videotape message from Angela Davis.
Mm-hmm.
We had Professor Cornell West there.
Mm.
He spoke in person. He came to the dinner. Also, Abby O'Dune of The Last Poets.
Nice.
Was there.
Mm-hmm.
And we just had a great, great evening. Good food, good people, you know. Mm-hmm. It was just great. And we raised funds for Mumia's War Chest. So it was just a very, very warm family vibe. You know, a really good evening. And then on Saturday, that was the major program. There was a rally and march from 19th and Cecil B. Moore Avenue in North Philadelphia. That was the original Philadelphia Black Panther Party headquarters and the home of Captain Reggie Shell of the Panthers.
Mm-hmm.
And people rallied there and marched from there, from 19th and Cecil B. Moore, to the Church of the Advocate. And that's at 18th and Diamond. Once there, there was all kinds of activity. There were activities for the children, face painting and various activities. There were vendors, food vendors, vendors of clothing, T-shirts, jewelry, just books and, you know, all kinds of vendors, which was great. There was entertainers, Immortal Technique, M1 of Dead Prez, and just a huge number of other entertainers that, you know, skip my mind right now, but it was great. Taina Asili, who is a Latino woman who has a beautiful voice and a beautiful, you know, band that she works with. It was just great. There were workshops on political prisoners, the intimidation of lawyers, you know, who dare to step up for their clients. There was a workshop on the media, you know. It was just so much information put out for people, you know, entertainment. It was just great for all ages, Wanda, for all ages.
Yeah, it sounds really wonderful.
Yeah.
I don't think I've heard of anything quite like this on Mumia's birthday before. This sounds
right. Well, it was his 60th birthday, which is a
significant
milestone.
Yeah.
Wow. You know, so we wanted to do it big to call people's attention to it, you know.
Yeah, yeah. What year is this for him?
What, he was arrested in 81, so it's 33 years.
Oh, my God.
This year.
Wow, wow. Yeah. And so you said funds were raised for his war chest. So what's going on with his case now? He's in general population, but he's still not out. What's going on with that?
Well, you know, right now, you know, we don't really ever like to cause any dissension or division, but we have had issues with the attorneys for Mumia, the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, because when Obama nominated Debo Adebili for the Justice Department, and the Fraternal Order of Police went crazy and misused Mumia's case, saying that Adebili, you know, supported Mumia, represented him, and, you know, that whole bit, and used that to denounce Debo Adebili and say that there is no way that he should be, you know, in the U.S. Justice Department. And they just blatantly lied on me. I mean, they just recycled these 32-year-old lies, 33 years at this point,
right,
you know, lies that have been disputed
right
for the past 33 years. And the Legal Defense Fund, who supposedly represents Mumia, didn't say a word. I mean, they did not come to Mumia's defense to dispute these lies. They just let them stand. And we had a meeting with them. You know, Mumia's supporters had a meeting with them saying, what is your problem? How can you allow these lies, you know, to just stand like that without putting the truth out there to dispute these lies? And they were saying really ridiculous things like, well, our arena is in the courtroom, and, you know, like they don't do anything else, which is a lie, because they put out several lukewarm milquetoast statements in support of Debo Adebili, but they did that. That wasn't in the courtroom, you know? So they were just making excuses, and we were like, no, this is not acceptable at all, you know? So we have a problem with them. And, you know, I don't know what else to say except that they are not really representing Mumia. We cannot fire them. People have been making Mumia aware of the issues that people have with them because they did not come to his defense. And, you know, whether or not to fire them is up to Mumia.
Mm-hmm.
But they have not even come up with any, you know, legal arguments to get Mumia back in court. And we're not saying that that is an easy task because the only way Mumia can get back into court is if they can discover new evidence that wasn't available, could not have been discovered before. And, you know, that's a hard task right there, and we understand that. But our position is even if you can't get him back into court right now and you keep looking for ways to do that, how do you sit back and allow the Fraternal Order of Police to just put these lies out there? How do you do that? So, you know, that's where we're at with Mumia's case and these attorneys, the legal defense fund. So that's where we're at on that.
Okay.
At the same time, we are engaged in a battle for the Move 9 on this parole issue. And that's a serious battle right there because the parole board, as you know, just keeps refusing to parole the Move 9, any of them. And they keep saying because they won't take responsibility for their crimes on August 8th of 78. And we're saying, what crimes? They've been telling the parole board and anybody else that will listen for the past going on 36 years now that they did not commit a crime. The judge on the case, Edwin Malmet, who heard their case without a jury and was the person solely responsible for the determination of innocence or guilt, at the end of the trial, he convicted the Move 9, but then went on a radio program and said, he did not have the faintest idea who killed Officer James Ram. Now, that is just ridiculous because whether it's a judge or a jury, they are supposed to be certain beyond a reasonable doubt if they convict somebody. Now, Judge Malmet sat up there and said he didn't have the faintest idea. So where does that leave reasonable doubt? Sounds like he had plenty of doubt. He didn't have the faintest idea, you know, who killed that cop. So, you know, for the parole board to demand that Move people lie and say that they committed a crime that they didn't, is absolutely ridiculous, you know? And we're not going to sit by quietly and accept it. So we're battling the parole board. We have people writing the parole board, calling the parole board, demanding that Move people be released. You know, when you add to the issue that the very judge who sat on the case said that he didn't have the faintest idea of who killed that cop. When you add to that the fact that Move people have done their entire sentence in jail, people like me, my sister Sue Africa, my sister Alberta Africa, Mo Africa, you know, we did our entire sentence. And we were released in the 90s, early 90s, and not one of us has been back to jail. Not one of us has been arrested for anything, you know. Carlos and Consuela Africa were paroled in the early 90s and completed their parole and have never been arrested again.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, what is their problem in paroling MOVE people? Obviously, when MOVE people come out here, we're not likely candidates to be, you know, rearrested. You know, they always talk about recidivism.
Right.
You know, obviously MOVE people are not candidates for, you know, recidivism, of going back. So why do they have so much trouble paroling MOVE people? The prisons that my family is in recommend MOVE people for parole, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So that's the fight we're engaged in now. And one thing that we're going to be doing is we're going to approach organizations of attorneys,
mm-hmm.
like the National Lawyers Guild, like the barristers, and any other organizations that, you know, we can think of.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to request that they go into the case of the MOVE 9 on two issues only. They don't have to go past two issues, Wanda. The first one being the destruction of MOVE headquarters. You know, basically before my family was even processed on charges in August of 78, and how once the evidence was destroyed, once the scene of the crime, MOVE headquarters, was demolished, that they should not have been able to proceed with the trial at that point. They deliberately destroyed vital evidence,
mm-hmm.
the scene of the crime. The second issue that we're going to request that they review and look into is the fact that the trial judge, you know, who sat on that case without a jury and, you know, who was supposed to be paying close attention and making a just verdict, convicted our family, gave them 30 to 100 year sentences each, and then said he didn't have the faintest idea who killed that cop.
Hmm.
How can a conviction like that stand? You know?
Mm-hmm.
So those two issues we're going to be requesting that, you know, organizations like the Barristers and the National Lawyers Guild and any other organizations of attorneys that we, you know, can get to review this and look into this and then issue a report on it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to do that as well.
Yeah.
Also, the district attorney here in Philadelphia, Seth Williams, the first black district attorney, he has said, and it's only words at this point, that he is creating a unit in the district attorney's office to review questionable cases, cases where there could be prosecutorial misconduct, judicial misconduct, you know, where innocent people could be in prison. And we're saying we know 10 of them right off the bat, the MOVE 9 and MOMIA,
mm-hmm.
you know. So we're going to be pressuring him, you know, to have this new unit to review the case of the MOVE 9 and MOMIA. So that's, you know, what we're involved in now. That's what we're working on, as well as traveling and you know, activities that we have been involved in for decades and continue to be involved in. So,
mm-hmm. yeah.
We're definitely on the move.
Certainly, certainly. So Friday when you arrive tomorrow, you're going to be in San Francisco Friday, May 2nd, 6 p.m. At 518 Valencia Street, and you're being hosted by the National Lawyers Guild.
Right.
And you mentioned, you know, just a few minutes ago.
Yeah.
That, yeah. So Are you in conversation with them, or are you going to present this proposal to them?
No, we're not in conversation with them right now, but in fact, I want to present, you know, to the National Lawyers Guild chapter here in Philadelphia, you know, people that are close and can review it. If, you know, organizations across the country, National Lawyers Guild chapters across the country want to be involved in this, that's great. Obviously, we're not going to say no, we don't want you to do that. But we just want to focus on people that are right here and would have easy access, you know, to records, to information, you know.
Right.
So when I said the National Lawyers Guild, I was speaking more so in Philadelphia. And we have been working with Heidi Boghossian out of New York, who is the executive director of the National Lawyers Guild, you know, and she's in New York, and she's familiar with our case. So we have, you know, been in regular contact with her and have worked with her. So I don't perceive this being a difficult project to get these organizations involved in.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it should be something that they should be ready and willing, you know, to delve into, because it's so clear. I mean, how much clearer can you get when evidence, vital evidence, the scene of the crime was destroyed on the day of the arrest before move people were even processed by order of the city of Philadelphia. And I should also say this was done despite the fact that a judge named Calvin Wilson, a black judge, had issued a court order that nothing was to be done with that house before they had a hearing on a permanent injunction from, you know, doing anything on that house. This was even before it became a crime scene, before it became vital evidence. There was a court order in play, you know, forbidding anybody, city officials, whoever, anybody, from doing anything to that house. It became a crime scene where a cop was killed, and they ignore that order and go right on in and demolish it.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah.
I mean, just those issues alone, the destruction of the house, and Judge Malman saying he doesn't know, doesn't have the faintest idea who killed those cops. I mean, you can't get past that.
Yeah. And that film, the recent film, I think it came
out. Let the Fire Burn?
Yeah, it was, like, so clear. I mean, they're on record. And then just reflecting on it, the people that were there, you know, saying, well, the order was don't touch it. And then I don't remember who it was that said it didn't matter. You know, I want you to, you know, bomb it anyway or set the fire anyway. Just disregard for, you know, these judicial steps and mandates, you know, the legal mandates, you know, not having respect for them yet expecting other people to have respect.
But see, this is what MOVE have been telling people for close to 40 years now. That these people don't care. They don't give a darn about no legality. They want to shove it down people's throat, down our throat, you know, and demand that we, you know, respect it, accept it, and all of that. But they don't. They don't, you know? And I mean, come on, who do they think they're dealing with? And why should people accept this kind of contradiction? You know, when the Fraternal Order of Police went crazy on Debo Adebili and him, as they say, representing Mumia, which he did not, but that's not the issue. The point is, what are they talking about, Wanda? They claim, they have to admit, that the Constitution guarantees even the most heinous committers of crime adequate legal representation. Now, what are they saying? Everybody deserves zealous legal representation but Mumia? What is their point in talking about Ida Bailey representing Mumia or being involved in Mumia's representation in any kind of way? What is their point? The Constitution that they're supposed to represent guarantees everybody, no matter who it is or how much you hate them, mm-hmm. it guarantees them zealous legal representation. But they don't care about that when it comes to Mumia or Move or Panthers, you know.
Mm-hmm.
They don't care about that. They throw legality out the window, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But they want to demand that the people respect it, you know,
mm-hmm.
and adhere to it. And, I mean, it's ridiculous. It's ridiculous, but this is what Move people have been telling people ever since Move,
mm-hmm.
that these people are a mass of contradictions. They're not trustworthy, you know.
Mm-hmm.
They don't care about justice or equality, you know.
Mm-hmm.
They have one agenda, keeping this system going, doing whatever they feel like is in their interest. And if legality happens to coincide with that, fine.
Mm-hmm.
But if it doesn't, then to hell with legality.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They don't care.
I wanted to ask you if you could give people that are interested in, you know, following up with writing the parole board, as you mentioned, around the Move 9.
Right.
How can they stay sort of in touch with Move and finding out what's happening with these different cases? And I presume the information about writing the parole board might be on the website. Is that correct?
Yes, it should be. I'll double check, but it should be. What people can do is they can go to our website, www.onthemove.com. They can email me at onthemove, that's onamoveellja, @gmail.com. They can call me at 215-386-1165. And they can write the parole board at Pennsylvania Board of Probation and Parole, Ray, that's RE: Inmate Inquiry, and the address is 1001 South Front Street, Suite 5300, Harrisburg, PA, 17104. But I'm not that technologically advanced that I can do websites, so somebody does it for us and you know, updates it and all of that. I have not been on the website in a while, so I will double-check and make sure that the information about the parole board is on there. There's also a blog spot, and that information is on the website. It's like move9parole.blogspot.com, I believe it is.
Okay, I'll check it and find it and give people the URL.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah, so that should be on there.
Okay.
But people can contact me, you know, through the email or through the number I gave.
Okay, great. Also, when you all are here, with Lynn Stewart and you know, and your sister Pam Africa, both of you are traveling here together. You're going to be making stops in San Jose, and then you'll be making the stop in Oakland. So San Jose on May 3rd, Oakland on May 4th, and Monday you'll be in San Rafael, and Tuesday you'll be Tuesday May 6th you'll be in Sacramento, and no.
Yeah. Pam and I are going to have to come back Monday. We're coming back to Philly on Monday because we have our May 13th program, you know, remembering the bombing of MOVE. Actually, it's going to be on Saturday, May 10th. So we're coming back on Monday the 5th because, you know, the rest of the week we're going to have to nail down everything, you know, for our program. So we won't be in San Rafael, is it, on Monday, and Sacramento on Tuesday.
Okay.
We won't be there. We'll be in San Francisco Friday night. We'll be in San Jose Saturday and in Oakland Sunday.
Right, yeah. So I want to talk a little bit about Mother's Day weekend, 1985, when MOVE was bombed on May 13th. I mean,
Simply, people need to understand that in August of 78, the government sent their cops out there to kill MOVE. This was not about a plan to arrest. It was about a plan to kill off the MOVE organization. They failed miserably. They did not kill MOVE people in August of 85, and they were furious about it. So in August of 78, in May of 1985, they came back out to our home determined to do what they had failed to do in 1978. That is why they came not only with the artillery of war, but with a bomb, and they have yet to explain or attempt to justify their actions in May of 85, because nothing they have said justifies what they did, and people should really, really understand that. I mean, MOVE people weren't accused of rape, robbery, murder, pushing drugs, molesting children. I mean, we weren't accused of anything like that. What did they say? We were bad neighbors, you know, disorderly conduct or whatever. I mean, that justifies dropping a bomb, which ignites a fire, you know, and making a conscious decision to let the fire burn, shooting over 10,000 rounds of bullets at us. You know, come on. This is absolutely ridiculous. As a result of their warlike actions in May of 85, and because their intent was most definitely to kill, they let the fire burn. They shot at us, you know, as we tried to come out of that burning building, and they didn't intend for anybody to survive. As the only adult survivor of that massacre, I am the only person to be charged with anything and to go to prison, you know? So I don't know how many more examples people, you know, will need to really not only talk about how vicious and unjust and, you know, this system is, but to start doing something about it, to really, you know, jump out there to do something about it, because there are people who fight back, and that's MOVE's motto. We fight back. And, you know, that's one reason that this system hates MOVE people so bad and wants to kill us, because they don't want others influenced by our example, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But the point is, whether you fight back or you don't, you still get victimized by this system.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Oscar Grant wasn't out there demonstrating and talking about down with this rotten system, or, you know, kill the pigs, move, don't call cops pigs, but, you know, that's a common phrase, you know, out there.
Mm-hmm.
Oscar Grant wasn't doing any of that, but he was murdered by the police nonetheless. So when you're threatened by something, something is threatening you, your family, your babies, there's only one solution. John Africa teaches us when something is threatening you, the only solution is to get rid of the threat, stop the threat.
Right.
You know, otherwise, as long as the threat exists, you're not safe. You're not secure.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so.
Yeah. You're packing as we talk.
Yeah. Sorry.
Yeah, I was reading that Birdie Africa, also known as Michael Moses Ward, the only child survivor of the 1985 bombing on May 13th, that he died last year. Is that true?
Excuse me, yes. He passed away in September.
Mm.
We had not had any contact with him, really, since May of 85.
Oh.
The only contact we had with him was when he came to court and testified at my federal lawsuit that I filed and in my criminal trial in 85.
Yeah.
His biological father, who the government made sure got custody of Birdie.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry, my throat is getting so dry. They made sure he got custody of Birdie, and because they knew that he would do his best to make sure Birdie had no more contact with us.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we didn't have any contact with him at all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. So I'm going to let you go in a minute, but I wanted to ask you how it's been, you know, sort of celebrating this win, you know, with the release of Lynn Stewart. You know, it's really wonderful that she's been released.
And Eddie Marshall Conway.
Right,
Marshall,
yeah.
Eddie Conway.
Mm-hmm, yeah, and then, you know, Maroon Schultz is now out of solitary.
In population, yeah.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
I mean, you know, we have to celebrate our victories and use that to push forward, you know, to never give in and to keep backing the system off of us, you know.
Mm-hmm.
When we have victories like that, it's no time to, like, relax and you know, lay down.
Mm-hmm.
It's time to up the ante and put even more, escalate the pressure, put more pressure on them.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, certainly, certainly. Well, I'm sure that informs, you know, your political activism and movement, as you say, and travel. It's really, really admirable the way keeps on moving.
Yeah, well, we don't feel like we have a choice. I mean, we don't see an option,
mm-hmm.
you know. We're not hallucinating that there is anything else to do, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So that's what keeps us going.
Right, yeah. Well, I'm going to let you continue your preparations and
yeah, we have a 7:45 a.m. flight, which
yeah.
means we have to be at the airport, they say, 2 hours ahead of time.
Mm-hmm.
So we have an early morning.
Right, yeah. Well, safe travels, and look forward to seeing you when you touch
down. Yeah,
touch
I look forward to seeing you too, Wanda. It's been a while.
Yeah, it has been.
Got a big hug waiting for you.
Oh, I'm looking forward to it.
Okay.
All right, you take good care.
You too. Right. On the move.
On the move. Peace and blessings. Well, that was Ramona Africa speaking about her visit to the San Francisco Bay Area last week, and now they're making preparations for this weekend anniversary of the bombing of the Move House on Osage Avenue. Gosh, in 1985, where everyone was killed except Ramona and Birdie Africa, and now Birdie is now deceased, so Ramona is the only survivor, and they're going to be showing the film Let the Fire Burn, which is a really remarkable documentary. So I'm going to close the program with an interview with Erica Huggins about the Black Power mixtape, and that particular film is also available, and Erica Huggins was also imprisoned for her political beliefs, and she talks about how she survived that. Well, I was wondering, I was actually with you, I was in the audience when we saw the Black Power mixtape as a part of the San Francisco International Film Festival earlier this year, and I heard some of your impressions when we were leaving, those of us who knew each other at that particular screening. But I was wondering, sort of, what are some of your initial impressions of the film, The Black Power Mixtape, that has opened in the San Francisco Bay Area about a week ago?
Yes, it's not only opened, it's being held over, I'm happy to say.
Yes, that is so excellent.
Being held over at the Shattuck Cinemas, mm-hmm. at the Piedmont, the Landmark Piedmont in Oakland, and also at the Embarcadero, Landmark Embarcadero in San Francisco. And it's also been held over in Los Angeles in a number of theaters. So we're really happy about that.
Mm-hmm.
And I say we because I've been supporting this film, Wanda, since that day.
Mm-hmm.
My impression is that the director of the film was not only brilliant in putting the footage together, he has fresh eyes. He doesn't put the American slant on the American experience. He doesn't tell us how to watch the film. He doesn't tell us what we're seeing. We're given the footage, and we are able to, as, you know, innately intelligent human beings, figure out what we're seeing.
Mm-hmm.
And having met him, I understand why I had such a wonderful feeling about the film and the necessity to get it out beyond film festivals and beyond small groups of people who critique film to communities at large. And so I've been supporting the film ever since that day.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah. You know, the film captures, you know, some of your great friends, Sophie Carmichael, you know, Kwame Ture, Angela Davis, and Kathleen Cleaver. And what I really enjoyed about the film was the way that they were humanized. Is, you know, they're accessible. They're like, oh, wow, I could do this. You know, I'm sure many young audience, you know, or viewers in the audience might think when they, you know, meet, you know, Kwame Ture, you know, in the living room of his mother interviewing her, or in a car, you know, traveling to, you know, a speaking engagement, or, you know, watched, you know, Angela Davis at, you know, some rally speaking. That's what I really enjoyed about that, as well as, you know, juxtaposing these iconic figures with artists who are younger, who are inspired by their work.
Yes, and what is your question again?
Oh, there wasn't a question. It was a comment. Yeah, and so with regards to, it says that the Black Power mixtape was, it's... I guess it came out on L'Ouverture Films, which is Danny Glover's company, and he was saying that that the film felt less like a documentary and more like a photo album lovingly pasted together by foreign exchange students who stayed with a black family in America for about 10 years. And the footage that was found and put together by two Swedish television journalists who set out to chronicle the Black Power movement in America, it takes place between 1967 and 1975. And when one reads your biography, you were, you know, you've got quite an extensive array of activities that you were involved in, you know, from, you know, where you say your political activism began in 1963 with the March on Washington to your, you know, founding the Los Angeles chapter of the Black Panther Party. So I was wondering, as you were watching the film, sort of what thoughts ran through your mind when you looked at that period of history and that you were actually a participant in at that time?
Well, my thoughts are were similar to yours, that mm-hmm. and to Danny Glover's.
Mm-hmm.
That there was a lot of love and care put into the film, and we got to see people who we have been taught to view as extraordinary people. We got to see them as ordinary people doing extraordinary things. And I believe that every person is capable of making an extraordinary contribution to our world. And that is exactly how I felt as a young teenager at the March on Washington, that I had to make a contribution to the world. I didn't understand how my life would unfold then. I didn't know that I would be a widow at age 20 and incarcerated 3 months later, and all of that. I had no idea. And that I would be separated from my daughter, who was just a baby. And that is the story of many people, not the specifics of my story, but the general story of standing up and stepping forward to transform the way that we interact with one another and perceive one another, that there are consequences. And as I watched the film, I remembered so much about how each voice and face of the older footage did that, and how the younger voices that we got to hear so lovingly support us in wanting to do more now, like Talib Kweli and Erykah Badu
mm-hmm.
and Robin Kelly.
Right, yeah.
And they are all in their own way doing what they can do to serve humanity. And that is one of the major things that the film prompts in us, that it is important that each of us do something in the skin we're in, with the people that we love, with the connections that we have made in our lives, no matter how young or old we are, and with the work that we're doing now, like your radio show, for instance,
mm-hmm.
So that we contribute to the upliftment rather than just critiquing what someone else or some group of other people have not done.
Right. Yeah. When I you know, read your biography, just looking at, you know, all of the different roles that you've played, around, HIV AIDS education and awareness, to being, you know, the director of the Oakland Community School, to your sharing with us how you were able to
to survive solitary confinement, you know, through instituting, you know, meditation as a means of survival, which you went on to teach others. And I believe we met when you were volunteer coordinator at the Shanti Project, because I was working, I was director of the AIDS Volunteer Clearinghouse, and I think that was when I met you. I mean, I knew you, of course, because you're famous, but I had never met you. And I remember when you were working with the Shanti Project, and I didn't know at that time that you were the first woman practical support volunteer coordinator there, and, you know, and that you were working, you know, with women and children with HIV in the Tenderloin and Mission districts of San Francisco, and then, you know, developing a citywide program for the support of gay, lesbian, bisexual, and questioning youth with HIV and AIDS. And I was just wondering if you could talk about sort of the trajectory that has been your life with regards to these various leadership roles, as well as your commitment to education, because wherever one looks, one sees you connected to some sort of institution around education. Like right now, you're a teacher at a professor at Laney College.
I just want to say that thank you for reviewing pieces of my life, but the trajectory is interesting for me. Mm-hmm. How I see life trajectory. It's all about not the choices that I made to do this thing or that thing or to be here or there, but the choice I made to follow my heart and to do what is needed in the moment. And so when I knew I had the opportunity, for instance, to work at Shanti Project, my response was, why wouldn't I? Look at the outrageous numbers of people of color and women and children of color who were then and now affected by the virus and its attendant illnesses. And so I stepped forward. And after that, I was asked to, after I was no longer at Shanti Project doing the work you mentioned in the Mission in the Tenderloin, that I did similar work with the AIDS Project of Contra Costa and started a similar program in North Richmond through a clinic. I didn't do them for any other reason, these things that you mentioned. I didn't do them for any other reason than to serve. And to do so in a way that seemed to be the most important at the time. And I believe, you call me a leader, I believe that you are a leader. You said that I was famous. I believe that you are famous. I believe we're all famous leaders.
Mm-hmm.
We just have to make the choice to lead, and the best leader is the leader without followers.
Mm.
So we just lead. We just step out there. And we understand the consequences, and we still step out. So that's why I've done what I've done. And I believe that teaching is the most revolutionary act that anyone can do. I definitely believe that that's true for me. Because in the classroom, I bring all of myself to the students that I'm with. And many of them don't know anything about my background, and I like that. And when they do, I don't hide it, I respond. But I show up as Erica Huggins, who is just their sociology teacher or their women and gender studies teacher. It doesn't matter to me, in other words, how they see me.
Mm-hmm.
What's important is that they're inspired to learn about their world, because the courses I teach are all about systems and how they work or do not to support human beings. So at Laney College, and now I teach at Berkeley City College, and when I teach at San Francisco State University or California State University, East Bay, I walk in with all of Erica Huggins in tow. I don't leave parts of myself at home or fear what another adult, another teaching adult or staff adult might say about who I am. Because you see, everybody, Wanda, does not consider me famous. Some people consider me infamous because of the perceptions they bring from their lives to who I am. So I hope that I'll be able to teach in some capacity and mentor, which is even more important to me,
mm-hmm.
in some capacity until I close my eyes on this life. At the underpinning, the foundation of my life is my practice of meditation. I believe that I'm sorry to say that we have misunderstood its importance. We don't, in most communities of color, we don't misunderstand the power of prayer. But a little girl once told me that prayer is when you're talking to God and meditation is when you're listening.
Hmm. Yeah.
She was 6 years old. And she figured that out because I used to go into the schools and take relaxation and very, very simple meditation and stretching exercises to the children so that they could develop internal locus of control. In other words, that they were the boss of themselves
mm-hmm.
rather than letting their emotions or their reactions guide them throughout the day. And it was all about, at the time when I was doing that work for 4 years with a particular program, schools expect little children to sit at a desk for almost 8 hours. That's ridiculous. Okay, well, that's what we asked them to do. How are we supporting them? So simple, mindful sitting for 5 minutes, deep breathing for a couple of minutes keeps them on task. Why am I mentioning that? Because it keeps me on task. And I hope that it keeps me humble enough to know that no matter what I've done, there is always more to do, and that the way to do it isn't in memory of all that I've done. I just do it. Because it is the next best thing to do. And as I said to you earlier, I listen from my heart. And the heart is not a weak place. When I'm at my most wise, I know that my mind is fine-tuned by my heart. So I hope I answered all of your questions that were in that last set that you asked.
Yeah, that was really beautiful because October is Black Panther History Month.
Yeah,
45 years, and there are going to be a lot of wonderful programs that quite a few of them hosted by It's About Time.
Yeah.
Black Panther Party, and I know Emory Douglas is going to be honored, really wonderful man, and I hope the film continues, you know, to be held over, which would be really great as well. Then people can go see the film in October, because that's just another week. But when I, and also October is also Ma'afa Commemoration Month, and when we look at sort of the Black Holocaust, and we reflect on the residual psychological effects of enslavement and how we can heal from the trauma. And we started in light of the Ma'afa Commemoration Month, a meditation series that started Monday. And I completely understand what you were talking about and what that little girl said about, see, God is listening. I'm trying to think, how did she put it?
When you pray,
yeah.
You're talking to God.
Right.
And when you meditate, you're listening.
Right, exactly. It was just so wonderful, and I'm so happy that I went to the meditation. It's a series of four Monday meditations, Ma'afa meditations and movement. So the 26th was the first one, and then we have one on the 3rd of October, the 17th and the 24th. And Dr. Lorenzo Penn is hosting them at the Oakland Center for Spiritual Living. And it was just, oh my goodness, it was just such a wonderful way to start the week. it was just so beautiful. I'm so looking forward to next Monday, and then after I get the hang of it, then I could start doing this daily.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Good. I'm so glad to hear that. And I hope listeners will understand that as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It is the one central thing that got me through solitary confinement.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I was just thinking when I read that in your bio, I was thinking about, you know, the fast that just started at Pelican Bay around, you know, the secured housing units. And then, yeah, I was just thinking about, you know, if the men and are, if they have a meditation practice there to help them, you know, in such sensory deprived spaces and in such harsh and violent to your soul spaces. I was wondering, you know, sort of how they're being able to keep themselves, you know, regenerated as they try to, you know, work toward justice as they, you know, started this fast up again since nothing happened with the CDCR. Because I know, go ahead.
Well, again, I'm not sure what your question is.
No, I was just wondering if that, because I know there, I saw this really wonderful movie called Vipassana, and it was looking at the use of this meditation practice in the prisons to help people. And I was wondering, I know it's in some prisons here in America, and I don't know which ones.
That was a service that I performed through my own spiritual community for years. I would go into the prisons, both state and federal, and the jails and the juvenile facilities, and take meditation. And I still do it as often as I can. As a matter of fact, I make a visit to the girls' wing and sometimes the boys and girls co-ed gathering at the Alameda County Juvenile Facility twice a year, at least.
Mm-hmm.
I would love to do it more. I think it's so important that when people are sitting with time, that they actually sit still with a purpose. And it really helps. It really does help. It helps with healing. It helps with an inquiring within to find what is the true meaning, the purpose, more the purpose rather than the meaning of one's life. And it prepares the person who sits for the future.
Mm-hmm.
Even if the future is 5 minutes from then, it prepares you for the next moment and the next moment. And that is what the joy of sitting quietly, as the little children call it in the schools, that's the joy of it. Because if you do it every day, you're more available to the moments of your life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, wow.
Rather than being tossed about by the moments of your life.
Mm-hmm. So literally, you could be the calm in the storm within yourself?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
That's why the educators call the thing that they brought me to do the development of internal locus of control. Where do we place control? Especially activists, we tend to place control outside ourselves. That's ridiculous.
Mm-hmm.
It's not ridiculous to be an activist. It's very important. But if we place power and control outside of ourselves, not recognizing that we can control ourselves from within and that we have power within, then we're able to meet those external forces with that inner power, which is absolutely infinite. And I know this from personal experience.
Hmm. Wow, yeah. So were you, as you, you practiced meditation as a means of survival. And you also wrote, I was wondering, did the two go together, your writing and your meditation?
Yes, and I believe that writing is improved by the practice of meditation because it brings clarity. It isn't just that meditation brings peace, it brings clarity and recognition of your innate power. So I was clearer on what it is that is necessary to write about.
Wow. So I guess since you have a meditation practice, each time that you meditate, is there a point where you're as clear as you're going to get, or is every time you meditate, different things come up and you find insight about different aspects that maybe you didn't know that you needed clarity on?
Well, you know, today, for instance, we're not going to have just one thing that comes up today, right?
Yes.
Many things will happen today. So, and then tomorrow, many things will happen, right? So, if we meditated yesterday, there's no guarantee that we won't need to be clear today or tomorrow. So the best thing to do is take care of our minds and our hearts by sitting quietly every day. We wouldn't go, we don't want to, sometimes we are forced to, but we don't usually go 24 hours without sleeping, do we?
Not unless we really have to, but normally we want to get some rest, yes.
Exactly. We don't consider, I'm not going to sleep today. We don't do that every day. But when it comes to meditation, which is rest for the mind and our inner awareness, we say, I don't have time for that. Once we understand it, we know that that's kind of hilarious.
Yeah.
We wouldn't go without sleep. Our bodies couldn't take it. And our minds would start crumbling after a while. But we don't consider the importance of the health of our minds, and we need our minds in order to serve humanity. We need clarity of mind. So you get more and more clear as you go, but I think it's unwise to take a veteran attitude toward it.
Oh, yeah, certainly.
You don't need to do it anymore because you, well, some people think that. Someone said to me a couple of weeks ago, I used to eat really healthy, but now I don't. And then she paused and she said, huh, am I bragging about that? We were talking about longevity, about being available in our minds, our bodies, our spirit to continue to serve. And she made that statement, and then she corrected herself, of course, because we do need, we're always learning, and meditation helps a person to learn about themselves, especially in relationship to the world that they're in and the people in it.
Yeah, wow, rest for the mind. I never thought about meditation in that way.
Most people don't, but that's what it does.
Yeah, and certain things are non-negotiable. And like you brush your teeth every day, and so you're supposed to exercise your body, and certainly you need to rest when you exercise your body and rest your mind. Yeah, I'm going to start taking time out to rest my mind even before I learn all the fancy things in class. Yeah, because I could just sit still. Wow, thank you. I had never thought of it like that.
You're welcome.
Wow, this has been so lovely speaking to you today.
Oh, you too.
Yeah, it's been a long time we've been trying to connect, and it's been really lovely. Yeah, I didn't know where the conversation was going to go, and I didn't know what we talk about, because Yeah. Well, this was really a blessing, and I really want to thank you so much for sharing with us, you know, some of your ideas and impressions and feelings about the Black Power mixtape, which I'm so happy is continuing, and just in general about your spiritual practice and how you maintain, you know, your calm within the storm that is spinning around us all the time, but we don't have to necessarily spin with it.
That's right, we don't. Well, thank you for interviewing me, and I want to encourage people to go out and see Black Power Mixtape, and that when they do see it in Berkeley or Oakland or New York or Los Angeles or Pasadena, that they see it with the awareness that that was then, yes, and here we are now in 2011, and what can we do? What can we continue to do?
Mm-hmm.
So thank you very much for having me on your show, and I will, I know we'll see each other again.
Oh, yeah, I'm certain we will see each other, you know, during October, Black Panther History Month, and you know, our paths do cross quite frequently.
Yeah. Okay.
All right, you take good care. Thank you again.
Thank you.
All right, peace and blessings.
You too. Have a great day.
Thank you, you too.
Bye.
Bye-bye. So that was Erica Huggins speaking about the Black Power mixtape, which is now available. You can actually probably get it at the public library. You can purchase it. That was a great interview with a wonderful woman. And definitely we need to take time out to meditate, to renew and rejuvenate our minds, which are always busy, always working. So definitely need to remember that and take time out for to allow our minds to rest. I'm going to close the show with a rebroadcast of another interview. This one here with Emily Palatin, Anton, and she is one of the protagonists in the film If You Build It, and it talks about a project that she and another architect, a program in a public school, and it talks about sort of using the tools of design and architecture to build lives and opportunities, as well as a structure in the school district where they were working to benefit the community. Practically. So it was a really wonderful film, If You Build It, and it opened in February. And now it might be available as well. And Emily actually has a school in Berkeley where she teaches children design and how to build practical and useful buildings and other types of devices for the community there, If You Build It. Well, again, so saying off the air, I just think that your project, my goodness, it's just so fantastic. Let's see, Project H Design.
Yeah.
And I just wondered, I know what architecture is, but I don't know what design means. I was wondering if you could tell my audience sort of what does that mean to be a person that has a master's of product design? What does that mean to be a designer?
Oh, wow. That's like a loaded, long question. I'm going to answer that how I define it, which
sure.
I think is probably different than most people. I mean, I think design in the general sense,
mm-hmm.
people believe to be about beautiful objects and luxury. It's like, oh, design is this additive thing that makes, you know, it's valuable and fancy and elitist in some ways. Like, it's a privilege to be able to hire a designer or whatever. And A lot of the reason I started Project H was to kind of throw that out the window and say that, you know, design isn't, it is those things, but it's also just like a really great way to solve problems. It's about creativity and ingenuity and making something beautiful out of nothing. And so for me, being a designer just means that I get to constantly critique things and then do something to make it better. And whether that's a building or, you know, just like a daily ritual or anything, like that's kind of the way I live my life and the way I work with my students is to question everything and then propose a different solution and then go out and build it.
Yeah. And then I was looking at your book, Design Revolution, 100 Products That Empower People, and I'm like, wow, I really like the one about the glasses that adjust to your vision needs. Oh, my goodness, I'm going to buy the book, like, today.
Oh.
and then the one about the landmines, how the... That's so wonderful,
because
there's so many landmines out there, you know, where, you know, unfortunately, you know, our arms have, you know, we've created all this, we've left all this waste that's toxic and dangerous, and just leaving it, and then children are losing limbs, and it's just horrible. And it's like, wow, that is so neat. And then the Braille-based Lego-style design building blocks, it's just so wonderful.
Yeah.
How did you, I mean, you know, design and architecture, that's, you know, that's math and science, and, you know, you don't see a lot of girls doing those kind of things. How did you happen to sort of, you know, not only be interested in this particular field, but actually be supported in your interests by your family?
Yeah, so architecture is math and science, but it's also like social studies and art, and you can't do it well without both sides of your brain. And so when I was a kid and I was like a big nerd and really excited about school, I think the reason I studied architecture is because it was this place and topic that allowed and required me to be curious about everything. Like, yeah, you have to solve for X to make sure that this beam doesn't fall, but you also have to know, you know, where is this building going to live and for what type of person and how are they going to use it and what's the history of that place? Like, there's all this social science to it also. And, you know, as a woman, I never even really thought twice about whether it was a place I should or shouldn't be. It was just like, duh, that's what I'm going to do, period. And I'm only now starting to realize and observe that with some of my female students, there's this moment in, you know, around middle school age where I think girls are becoming more alienated from school in general. Like, they're either going to zig or zag. They're either going to say, I'm curious, I'm excited about this, and I'm going to go to school and I'm going to own it. Or, you know, they end up getting caught up in less productive things, whatever that may be. So I think that for me, what's exciting about design and architecture is it's this like empowering thing that when I teach a 10-year-old girl how to weld, she walks out of that room and she's like, I just fused metal, don't mess with me, and also I can do anything else. So that's really rewarding to me, and that's, as a girl at that age, 10, 11, 12, I had experiences like that. I didn't learn how to weld at 10 years old, but I remember having certain experiences that changed my perception of what I thought I could do.
Nice. Were you raised in the San Francisco Bay Area?
I was born in Chicago, but then I moved here with my family when I was something like that. And I lived right on the Oakland-Piedmont border, and then my parents moved to Marin County when I was in kindergarten.
Okay. Yeah. Wow, so you're Bay Area.
Yeah.
Yeah, wow. So tell us about, you know, this this call that you and Matt Miller got, and from the, superintendent. Chip Zellinger of the Birdie County, North Carolina school district. And, you know, he called you and asked you to come and do what you do there.
Yeah, that was it. I mean, it was this random call from this renegade guy, and we thought, well, of course, we're going to go. And he had asked us to build these playgrounds for him that we designed. And so we went there, and we built these playgrounds, and then thought, okay, that was fun. little did we know, he had, like, a whole laundry list of other projects that he wanted us to work on. We built three computer labs, a weight room for the football team. We did a countywide graphic campaign. And we just, like, he was such a kindred spirit, you know, like he was up for anything. Any crazy idea, he was like, great, go do it, which is like your dream client, you know. So when we pitched this idea of a class, like how do we take the things that we do as architects and put that in the classroom? Like what does that mean for a student to experience that? He was all for it, and he's like, that's great. Like, whatever you need, go. So that was pretty much the beginning of it. I mean, that was the green light.
Yeah, so talk about, you know, the Studio H concept, the design build curriculum, and then, you know, the film is If You Build It. And I was wondering, it seems as if you all knew that there was going to be a film right from the beginning, you know, when the director Patrick with Creedon and his wife Christine O'Malley, they were with you all from the beginning, you know, like when you knew you were going to be doing Studio H. And I was wondering, you all have been doing things like this, but had you ever actually had a classroom and did what you did that we see in the film prior to this?
No, never. I mean, Matt and I had both taught at the university level, but never high school kids. And you know, that was scary in one way and also, like, not scary at all in another. We felt like it was the logical and necessary step for us within Bertie County. So in a way, it was like a responsibility. Like, we felt like we owed it to the students that if we were going to be in Bertie County and be pushing for more creativity and design, it felt like an injustice to not give students access to that. So, yeah, we absolutely went into it thinking, okay, like, I guess we're high school teachers now. But really, like, I think the way in which that we taught didn't feel like a normal class anyway. Like, we ran it as if it were a college-level studio. We had drafting tables. There were probably 3 days in 2 years where we stood in front of the class and gave a lecture. Like, that's just not ever the way we ran our classroom. So the model for us was, like, let's treat this like an architecture firm. We have a project that we need to deliver on, and we are a team, and we're going to make it happen. So my role as a teacher was less about instruction and more like leadership of this project that had to come to fruition.
Yeah, and how did Studio H fit in with the other academic, you know, classroom, you know, work that the children were doing? I noticed we you know, in the film we see that some of their education was more like distance learning. I mean, they weren't actually doing things. They were actually watching people exercise on or play. They didn't actually have sports.
Ridiculous.
It was on the computer.
That's
I'm
ridiculous.
Like, what?
Yeah, no, it didn't. I think that's both tragic and really powerful that, you know, I have a student now who I still talk to named Stevie. He's the farm boy who hates school.
Yeah.
And if you ask him, he's like, I don't care about or remember anything from high school except for Studio H. And, yeah, I mean, they spent half the day with us, and they spent the other half of the day staring at a screen taking online PE. Like, are you kidding me? So, unfortunately, I wish that our program could have been more connected to and reinforcing what they were learning in their core classes. And the school that we're at now in Berkeley, absolutely, that's what we do. It's, you know, we are the place where core subjects make sense, you know. But in Bertie, no, we were like we were the crazy people in the barn, and everything else was like either online or totally rote, like direct verbal instruction with kids in seats and teacher at the front. So I would have loved to have had more of a working relationship with the other classes and teachers, but it just wasn't that way.
Yeah, it was really, it was amazing the way the school board didn't support what you all were doing, you and Matt were doing in Studio H. And the children were making, you know, you first you taught them about the equipment and how to be safe, and they started small, and then they had the fundraiser, which is really cool, and, you know, the things that they made for the fundraiser. And then, you know, they were growing to this big project where they were going to build something for the community. I'm like, wow, this is so wonderful. And you're right, it was more like you all were collaborating with the young people, and whatever they, you know, their voices and their ideas counted and they mattered, particularly, you know, all the way to the design of this huge project.
Yeah, and the farmer's market idea was theirs. Like,
yes.
We never said to them, this
mm-hmm.
is what you will design. And the idea of ownership, like most people are 99% of their lives are consumers. Like, if you go to the Apple store to buy an iPhone, you, in a sense, you pay for that thing and you own it in a way, but not even close to the type of ownership that you feel when you say, I need this thing, I'm going to build it, and I'm going to maintain it, and it's mine.
Mm-hmm.
That's like a completely different type of ownership, and that's what those kids felt over that entire project. Like, that was their project, and nothing was going to get in their way, including their own school board that's not serving them. They, at a certain point, we were all just like, whatever, like, we're still going to build it, and it's still going to be beautiful, and whether or not they're at the opening ceremony, it doesn't really matter. Like, that's not the audience. The audience is the mayor and all these people that were rallying behind us, that came to the opening ceremony, that continue to sell produce out of the farmers market,
mm-hmm.
the new jobs that it created, like, that's what mattered, and that's what mattered to the kids.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah. So for the 2 years, you all didn't get paid. You were volunteering your services to this community. That is amazing.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, it was really frustrating, but also never a question. Like,
mm-hmm.
I really think that the school board thought, oh, if we just tell them we're not going to pay them, they'll leave, because that's what they did with everyone else.
Mm.
Teach for America, gone.
Oh.
Like, all these other programs, gone. But with us, you know, they said, okay, well, we're actually going to tear up your contracts. And that they really, I think, expected us to leave, and we didn't budge. I was like, okay, fine, screw
mm-hmm.
you, we're going to do it anyway. And if anything, we have all the more reason to do it even better now.
Mm-hmm.
So I felt like it was really important also to make the gesture to our students that we are here for you. No matter what anyone else says, no matter what anyone else wants to do to us, like, we're here for you and your education and what we think you're capable of for your town.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. Wow. So what are the takeaways for you, as a designer? And it was really interesting, you know, when you were talking about how, you know, as a woman of color, there were just certain places, you know, you couldn't go necessarily because of, you know, sort of the real conservative place where you were. And we could see in the film that was really frustrating for you because, you know, you can be all of yourself, you know, comfortably there.
That's a good way to put it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there were moments where I felt like I was in a Saturday Night Live skit a little bit, where, like, I would go into a room with Matt, and I would say something, and I would get shot down. And Matt would say the exact same thing, and everyone would go, oh, my God, that's brilliant. And it was the first time in my life I experienced, like, Matt's experience in Bertie was completely different than mine. And, you know, that's just because of who we are and where we come from and whatever. And so for a while it really bothered me, and I had this chip on my shoulder about it. But at the end of the day, just like with the school board, like, that does not matter. What matters is that when I walk into my classroom, my students respect me, and together we can do something great. So all of that other BS, I really had to work hard to just let go of
mm-hmm.
and focus on the people that mattered and the things that I could control, which was my classroom and what my kids were learning. And By the time we left, like, it was far less extreme.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't feel like an outsider. I really felt like that was my home. And, you know, I voted there. I felt like that was my place. But, yeah, certainly there was a lot of things that I had to grapple with personally and then let go of in order to be productive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Maybe you could tell us a little bit about sort of how you set up the Studio H, you know, with regards to your goals and objectives, and then you know, what of Studio H in Bertie County is a part of, you know, your is it Realm Charter School,
yeah,
in Berkeley,
yeah.
Now, like, what you know, what aspects of the Studio H, you know, are still living in this,
yeah,
new incarnation?
I mean, it's in a sense, it's exactly the same.
Okay.
And I think the thing that changes is just the project, but
mm-hmm.
the tagline for the program is design, build, transform.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that's really like as simple as it is. It's there's a design component. There's a creative space where we say, you know, I'm not going to give you floor plans to go build this thing. Like, we're going to come up with it ourselves, and we're going to make it audacious and beautiful and functional.
Mm-hmm.
So there's the design piece. And the build piece is really a challenge to students. Like, anyone can come up with a good idea, but can you make it real? We've never done a project that we haven't built. Like, there are no unfinished ideas. So,
Really?
That is so awesome. Well, I've this was my biggest pet peeve at Berkeley when I was studying architecture. I'm like, I'm going to design this thing and then never get to build it? Like, that's so stupid, you know? So
mm-hmm.
when we started Studio H, we made the promise to our students that anything that we design and take to a level of, like, construction documentation, we're
mm-hmm.
going to build it. Like, we just are. And for our students, that's where all the learning happens. Like, anyone can design a building, but can you put it up in a hurricane zone, in a flood zone, with
mm-hmm.
a specific budget, with a specific time frame, with a construction crew of teenagers? Like, that's where the challenge is.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where they, I think, learned the most. So the design part, the build part, and then the idea of transformation, that anything that we do in this class, we're not going to build birdhouses for our backyard. We're going to build something that is meaningful, like, to the public and has a civic discourse and is in response to a need and is hopefully providing a solution to it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So why don't you talk about, you know, some of the young people that, you know, were in Studio H, and it's really interesting that you said you still speak to
a lot of them.
To Stevie, yeah. And Stevie was the one that said in the film that his father didn't like school and his grandfather didn't like school. You know, they're just like, you know, being with the animals. And he's, you know, he's at the university.
Yeah, not only is he at NC State, he's on the dean's list.
Mm-hmm.
He wants to take an acting class.
Oh, my.
He's, like, become the informal spokesperson for this film. He's, like, he is the poster child for what Studio H can do for a kid. And I think every student, that, especially the ones I still talk to, like, they are far enough away from it now where they can look back and, like, articulate the thing that was powerful for them.
Mm-hmm.
But Stevie in particular, I mean, he's just, like, that's who Studio H was designed for, is the kid that, like, has spent his whole life underestimating himself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because wasn't Eric the one that he was, like, really meticulous and really good with?
Ron, yeah,
mm-hmm.
yeah.
Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah.
Yeah, that he's awesome. I mean, they're all awesome, and they're all, like, so different. And
mm-hmm.
I never wanted them to all become architects, you know, God forbid, but they've all found a way to take that kind of creative confidence and
mm-hmm.
do whatever it is that excites them with it.
Yeah. And it's interesting, Jamisha, you had two girls, which was really great. You know, she wants to be an OBGYN doctor, but she actually shot a lot of the footage, particularly
yeah.
that which is in the end of the film.
She was, oh my God, I love, Jamisha was like the sassiest, I love her, and she, I kept telling her, I'm like, Jamisha, you're an amazing interviewer, that's a skill, like, you're really good at it, and I have this secret dream that someday she'll have, like, a radio show or something, but, you know, that was her medium, like, I don't care what medium you pick, but, like, just pick something you're excited about, and that, for her, that was it, like, she wanted to be the rabble-rouser and, like, be up in everyone's face with a camera, and, you know, that's the lens through which she understood and processed that project, and she was great at it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Because in the film, If You Build It, they build really lovely chicken coops. I mean, like, wow. I mean, and the chickens were actually living in them.
Yeah, they still are.
Mm-hmm. I mean, those, like, really upscale chicken coops. I mean, my goodness.
Yeah,
and then you know the big project, the farmers market. That was huge. Who was your friend you brought in to help with the construction?
He's a old friend of ours. He's Eric Wanmacher. He mm-hmm. is just a builder dude that we call on in random moments where we need some extra hands.
Mhm. Yeah. So how did you all decide, you know, on what was, I mean, I know about the farmers market, you know, what could the class do for the community that would be really beneficial, and that was just, you know, really a win-win there. But the chicken coop and the other smaller projects, how did you decide sort of what they were going to build to sort of, you know, sort of get build up, to get their skills at the point where they could make, you know, do the huge project?
Yeah, everything's incremental. I mean, the mm-hmm. first thing, we wanted it to be fun, to be at a scale that was reasonable and, you know, kind of like the scale of a human body, like something that you could understand.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a game that all those kids play. And so we thought, like, what better thing than this fun object that doesn't feel intimidating? There's no big social agenda yet. You know, it's just, let's build these things and make them beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there's always a twist, though. Like, most of the cornhole boards that you see in Bertie County, they have, like, the John Deere logo, you know, or, like, the NC State logo. And so we said to them, like, a logo is not graphic design. Graphic design is an expression of an idea in two dimensions. And so we gave them this challenge, like, I won't go into it too much, but the graphics that you see on the boards are not logos. They're, like, they each had a concept that they had to represent in two colors in specific geometries,
mm-hmm.
and they're beautiful. You know, so I think that project was about doing something familiar that didn't feel intimidating, but also proving to them that they can push their ideas further than what they know. And then going into the chicken coop project, they had a little bit of confidence, like, my crazy ideas are not so crazy.
Mm-hmm.
And so when we asked them to do a chicken coop that didn't look like a chicken coop, they were more willing and able to push the boundary on what they thought a chicken coop looked like.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that was also the first time they had to design for a client, you know, like, albeit a feathered client, but, like, to consider, you know, something's going to live in this space, so what does that thing need? How does it live? Like, we built this kind of, like, makeshift coop just so we could observe chicken behavior.
Mm-hmm.
And originally we put all the food in this, like, trough type thing, and the chickens weren't eating out of it. And so we realized that chickens prefer to peck food out of, like, straw or grass rather than eat it out of a vessel.
Mm-hmm.
And so that, you know, for our students, they're like, okay, that influences our design. We don't need to build in all these fixtures. Like, they just need an open space. So all of the things that they observe behaviorally then influence the way they design the building. And then when we got to the farmers market, it was that much more natural to ask the questions of, like, how are we going to use it? How do people move through it? How does the light move? How does the air move? Yeah.
Hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Talk about, you know, the directors and your producers. And sort of, you know, they were with you from the beginning. Oh, and one more question before we leave the talking about the school for a minute in Bertie. How was it when, you know, Chip Zellinger was fired? I mean, and you all were sort of all alone all of a sudden.
You know, it was hard. Our biggest cheerleader was gone, but I don't think it ever really slowed us down, because there was never a question that we were going to leave. And you know, we've done a lot of other projects like that too, where you have some advocates and then some haters and some people in the middle, and you take all that into consideration. But I don't think we would have. Honestly, I think if Dr. Zellinger had been there the whole year, we would have done the same thing. I don't think his departure necessarily held us back. If anything, it gave us all the more reason to push forward.
Right, yeah.
I have just a couple more minutes.
Okay, sure. Let's see. So maybe a little bit about your producers and director, because I just think it's really great that you documented this, because, I mean, it's really good that you have a product that you could share with us about, you know, Studio H and, you know, and the, what was on the T-shirts that,
Design, Build, Transform.
Exactly. Yeah, the whole idea of, you know, of, designing being a philosophical, concept.
Yeah, and
I don't think I'd ever thought of it like that. I mean, of course it is. You know, you think of all the metaphors about building, right, and foundations and those kind of things. But to actually use it as, you know, sort of the philosophy of an academic program, that's really awesome. And then, you know, the children are using their large muscles, and then you have them, you know, doing some really you know, difficult analytical thinking, you know, when they had those, they had to take something and they had to put something together, and they all did it. I don't know how long it took. Hi.
Hey, so yeah, are we almost done? We have one more interview.
Okay, yeah, how many minutes? Two, maybe?
Yeah.
Okay, no problem. Okay.
Thanks.
Sure. Yeah. So I guess I have 2 minutes. So anyway, maybe I'll have you talk about your school in Berkeley and your staff.
Yeah, so we're now at this school, Realm Charter School, and it's the only public charter school in Berkeley, and it's a really interesting group of kids. I mean, I say Berkeley, and people are like, oh, Berkeley, but we have a really beautiful and odd population of kids. They're mostly from Richmond and Oakland, majority English language learner and or special education, and most of them come to us because the public schools, the quote-unquote normal or regular public schools, are just not working for them. And so they all come in the door, like, expecting and needing a different kind of classroom, and that's exactly the kind of environment we like to teach in. So we have 216 students now in 8th, 9th, 10th, and 11th grade. They have our class every single day. Our 8th grade class in particular, we just started this year with a middle school class, and they're like a whole different kind of nightmare slash dream. But, you know, they're 13 years old, and they're also like the big men on campus. You know, they're like at the top of the middle school. And so this year they decided that because they're the first graduating class ever for this charter school from the middle school, so their class gift to the school is to design and build the school library.
Oh,
and so we're about
nice.
To start that project this week, actually. And the design of it is just beautiful. Like, so I can't even believe how beautiful it is. And they're so excited about it. And it's one of those projects that, like, every single kid can find something to be excited about. Like, there's one kid that all he wants to do is create his own Dewey Decimal System for this library. There's another kid that's like, I only want to deal with the hardware, like the nuts and the bolts. So he's, like, nut and bolt guy. And then there's, like, the kid that only wants to do the CAD drawings for the, like, robotically created modules that we're printing. And so there's an entry point for every single student. And additionally, there's no excuse to not be excited about it, because there's so many different sides of this project.
Wow,
Yeah. Wow. Well, thank you so much for this lovely conversation, and hopefully we'll be able to have another one at some point. And congratulations on your film. And where is your school located? Where is Realm Charter School located?
It's in West Berkeley. It's on the corner of 8th Street and Addison, like right off. It's in that funky little industrial zone right off of 80.
Yeah, I know exactly where that is. Mm-hmm. Yeah, my children were in Berkeley Public Schools.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, and I had them in the, they had a carpentry program at the school right there on Claremont. And so they all learned how to use, they both learned how to use tools, and they built things and stuff like that. So, and I also have them in science and in math programs as well. So I'm really happy that there's, you know, that you all are here. And the Project H is a, you know, Studio H is a part of the Berkeley Unified School District. And, yeah, looking forward to, you know, coming by and seeing more.
Thank you. Yeah, thanks for doing the interview.
Oh, you're welcome. Congratulations on the great film.
Thanks.
You take care.
Bye-bye. Bye.